Accession number 4549, Reel 4.
Mr. Viles, Reel 4. So this zogging was a kind of tapping out the Morse code on the cockpit, was it?
That's correct, yes. It was a method, having open cockpits for the gunners at the back, we used to zog between aircraft if we're in formation, flight or squadron formation, anywhere, and we want to send a message to one of the other aircraft or to the flight leader or squadron leader. We used to zog out a message, which was a type of Morse code, and it was a matter of tapping on the side of the cockpit, on the outside of the cockpit, by closing your fist, and this was the dots on the outside of the cockpit, and then the dashes was the swing of the arm on the outside of the cockpit.
Scrapings, so, made a scraping sound.
No, just a swing of the arm. That was all. And it's a dot, dot, dash would sound like this. Dot, dot, swing the arm for the dash.
And was it an effective method of communicating?
Yes, absolutely, because all the other gunners and the pilots all knew Morse code. They could all read it. If I was on the extreme right, which I usually was, and I was zogging to someone in the flight who wanted a message, he wanted to know something, and I was zogging back to him, all the flight or the squadron, whichever was represented at the time, could read it. We had 5 aircraft in each flight, you see, one for the flight commander and 4 pilots, different, and 3 flights. So we had 15 aircraft, and then the squadron leader in charge of the squadron had his own aircraft. So altogether we had 16.
Was the job of air gunner a very prestigious one?
Yes. It was a very essential one for the simple reason that the only air gunnery school we had in the Air Force was at Cheppy Island, just off the Kent coast. And that was the gunnery school there. Well, if you wanted gunners immediately, you couldn't send men backwards and forwards from England to Iraq just to learn the gunnery course. It was just a matter of being learned on the spot by your corporal air gunner. And he would learn you right through, and you would be examined at the end of the period to see if you were worthy of becoming an air gunner. And it composed of gunnery, bomb aiming, assistant navigation, Morse coding, and practice bombing through the camera obscura was a means of practice bombing with smoke-filled bombs, that weighed around about 5 pounds each, and you took 8, and we had a practice site somewhere around about 10 miles out of the camp in the walls with a center white pyramid, which is the bomb aiming target. And you also used your Morse code key for this, and when you were on course, you pressed the key down, and that was heard in the camera obscura room, where they could pick you up by shadow by a large telescopic lens in the roof. And as you went across, they followed your shadow, and as soon as you took your finger off, that was the minute that you were supposed to have let a real bomb go. And then they would track you then for so many minutes, depending on the height you were at, and say, right, that's where the bombs burst there. So he's either left or right, undershot or overshot, or whatever or wherever he's gone. That point is there, they put an X. That's where his number one. And one, that's number one bomb. And you completed the 8, and then they would take an average of the 8. And everything was converted to 10,000 feet. So if you were bombing at 16,000 feet, it was converted down. So the distance was less than where your bomb went. If it was under 10,000, it was converted up. So you enlarged the distance. And that's how you did your practice bombing, before you did any live bombing of any kind.
How accurate could the bombing be?
Not very accurate. The bomb sites we had at that time were for the purpose, adequate, but not very good. And the best bomb that I ever placed was right bang on the target, was what we used to call a spitter. In other words, he could have gone 3 miles away. It went off and started this business.
Spinning.
And it went slap on the bang of the target, right on the pyramid. And we used to have 3 people out there, 3 miles away from the target, under a metal shelter with telescopes and a sight, and they had a sheet of paper which represented the in line at a certain angle with the target. And on the mark where that target went through their telescope, they could plot it on there and say, oh, that bomb went approximately 25 yards to the right. The other two would plot it according to where they were, and from the 3 readings, you would get exactly where the bomb did fall on the original target. So you'd have one sight in that way, one sight in that way, and one sight in that way, all doing a different plotting. So if this one read 25 yards, this one over here would be different, and this one over here would be different, and from the 3 readings, they would get the actual dead where that bomb went. They, for those 3 readings, crossing them over like that, they could get exactly where the 3 lines crossed, exactly where the bomb went. It mightn't be 25 yards. It might have been 40. And that's how they used to work it out.
What about air gunnery in those days?
Air gunnery, you started off by using your gun. You had to learn how to use your gun first. In other words, you had to learn how your gun worked, how it broke down and was reassembled, how any stoppages could be cleared. In those days, stoppages were quite frequent. Bad cartridges, breaches or whatever, a mark in a breach or anything like that can stop a cartridge going in and stop it firing. And these stoppages have got to be cleared. And you throw, just keep the damage. You never throw your cartridges away. You always keep them because they're money to the natives out there, and it's a very serious offense if they pick them up, if you start throwing them away. So you always try and hold them. In other words, what you do, if your gun is stopped, take your finger off the trigger, put the safety catch on, and lift off your ammunition drum. Have a look in the breech and see if there's one in the gun. If there is, take it out, put it safely away. Have a look at the one next one in the drum that's going to go in and see that there's no markings on it. Then check your breech and see if your breech is all right. Try one in the breech by hand. If it's all right, fair enough, it'll go. Put that cartridge back with the other one. And then put your drum back on and try it with a short burst over the side. That was your main way. Once you haven't got used to that on the ground, then you went up in the air with your gun. And your first... your first practices were air to ground, and the ground targets were sheets between poles at an angle, so that as you went past them at a certain height, it was your job to get as many shots on those targets as you went by them as you could, and each of your bullets were marked with a colored paint, your particular color, so you couldn't say, oh, that's so-and-so's shots. Or you couldn't say yours were his. You had your own colored. Each cartridge was tipped into a paint. Just a tip. So it went through. If it hit the target, it left a paint color on it. So they knew, oh, red, oh, that's Files. Blue, that's Jenkins. And so on. So then they could count how many times you'd hit. That was the air to ground. And then the air to air was what they call a drogue target. Flown behind another aircraft, about 200 yards behind it, in the form of a funnel, a canvas, a linen funnel. And you fired air to air over this, as far at the practice pitch, right out away from anywhere. On the Fallujah Plains, we used to do this. And you just followed the aircraft along, you dived on it from all angles, dropped on it and dived, come in from the sides, come up from the bottom, and you fired on it. As you went by, the pilot would shoot first with his front guns, swing off to let you shoot, and his color was different to yours, so that when that target was brought back, all the markings were taken off it, and the different colored paints, so that the markers knew how many shots had been fired by each gunner and pilots that had hit that target. and your scores read it, and you had to get a certain score to be able to be passable.
How difficult was it to hit the drogue?
Very hard, because we only had what they call a Norman wind vane sight on the guns, and this was a little, was a ball sight, which had small vanes on the side, which, according to the wind, the speed you were going at, and the angle you were going at, those vanes would go up and down like that and push the front ball sight up and down like that. That was a red front sight, a red ball. And you were sighting that from the back. And with the wind changing all the time, you had to get it so it was just steady before you started firing. Norman wind vane sight.
Did you have to reach certain standards?
Yes. You had to reach a standard laid down by the Royal Air Force to become a qualified gunner in every subject. And in India especially, you had another subject they had to look after. You had to learn about the habits and where they lived of the different tribes and whether they belonged to... what's the name there?
Pathans?
The Pathans are divided... All up the frontier, they're divided into two sects. One follows Mohammed, and the other follows his brother. And they both say that he's a true God.
Sunnis and Shias.
We're always cutting each other's throat. Now, that was an extra thing we had to do there, though that'll come later, probably. And we didn't have this trouble in Iraq, because we only had the true Mohammedans here. And that subject never came up. But we had the trouble when we were in Iraq. We had two lots of operations there against two different sheikhs who were rebelling against the British forces in Iraq.
Could you tell me about these two operations in which you were engaged in Iraq, Mr. Viles?
Yes, it was against Sheikh Mahmud up in the Kurdish mountains. And we would fly from Hinadi up to a place called Soleimania. And we had an entrance there and onto the strip there through a valley. And we should take off from there and go out. And first of all, we dropped pamphlets warning them that if they didn't get out of these villages or any part that we wanted them out of, we would bomb them. And we gave them 48 hours notice on that. And... our political officers up there, whoever they may be, I don't know who they were, but information came through that they weren't moving and they were still entrenched where they were. So we took out 112-pound bombs, 1917 stuff. And some of them were quite dangerous when you got to the bombing site because you find there was cracks in them and they were exuding and they were taken away and exploded independently. And we chose the ones we wanted that were good and were still had the rings secure to hang up on the bomb racks. And having bombed them up, we would take off from Soleimania and go to a designated place or village and blow it up if we could. Not everyone was a good bomb member. The bomb sites weren't so good as I mentioned before. But invariably, we got a good result, enough to move them somewhere away from there, so that we could move forces into there, the Iraq forces into there. And during this operation, we were unfortunate that flying officer Wells and LAC Freeze Green were shot down. Wells, the pilot, was shot to the shoulder and badly injured. And Freeze Green landed the aircraft on a very bad piece of ground. Well, I think he was awarded the DFN for that. And he was captured. Well, this went on for some time. And we went from various places, not just Soleimania, from Erbil, and even from our own base at home, we would fly up there. And then I was posted then to 70 Squadron. And I was just in time to get in on the surrender of Sheikh Mahmud, and Flight Lieutenant Webster went up with 55 Squadron as escort and accepted his surrender in the hills. And also, we recovered Flying Officer Wells and LAC Freeze Green and brought them back, and they were hospitalized for a while and sent back to UK.
What happened to the airman who was captured?
They were treated fairly well. The food was bad. They had to eat what they were, what the rebels were eating up there, whatever it might be. Some of it was mostly goats, goat meat, and a cross between goat and sheep. They had these animals were a cross between goat and sheep, and it was mostly a sort of a stew, no bread or anything like that, and no vegetables as such. They would eat roots and things like that that the rebels used to find and eat. And that was the only substance they had, really. And they were in pretty fit condition when we got them back, too. Anyway, this caused a little peace for a while, and then the cause was taken up by another sheikh, Sheikh Ahmed. He took up the cause. They were more or less sort of holy men. And, well, they were fighting in the name of holy men. And we had the same trouble again. And we were stationed then mostly at Erbil, which was an enclosed town and a holy city where the Islam priests, or whatever you might call them, were trained there or went there for their actual learning. And we were stationed outside on the airstrip out there. They didn't interfere with us. We did interfere with them. We never went into the city. We weren't allowed to. And that was going on still when I left to go to India.
What part did you actually play in these operations?
Well, if we saw any cattle around that we thought belonged to them, we just went down low and we just gunned them down. And if there was any specific place we knew where rebels were and they wouldn't move, we bombed them out until they did move.
But what about you personally?
I was bomb aimer and gunner. And there was also the pilot with his own front guns. I had the control completely of the bombing from the rear cockpit. That was my job, as bomb aimer and gunner. That was part of the gunner's job.
How much could you see of the rebels from the air?
You didn't see them. That was the trouble. You only got the information by wireless to us saying that they were there at a certain place. And that place we would go, we'd get the maps out and mark it out and our best route there and everything. And we would go and bomb them out. And once when we were at Sulaymaniyah, one of our sergeant pilots, Anthony, and his gunner, Nicholson, who was a very good friend of mine, as a matter of fact, they were coming back down the valley to land at Sulaymaniyah, and they got caught in a rush bar, which is the inverse of a tornado. Instead of going up like that, it came down like that.
And came down in a spiral?
In a spiral down onto the ground. Threw up everything and dragged the aircraft straight into the ground. It went up, bombs and all. And all we found was a bit of scarf and that. And they were buried at Hinidi Cemetery, where all the airmen were buried that were killed or died. And I was surprised because I was one of the escort party on the coffins, and the weight of them was terrific. And all we found was bits of scarf and clothes.
What were these things called? Russia bars, did
Russia
you
Russia bar, yeah.
Were they common in Iraq?
Not so common as you would say tornadoes are in the States or anything like that. But they came quite regularly. You get one here and there, but you never knew where it was going to be or when it was going to be. And they were unfortunate.
Were they difficult to avoid?
You couldn't avoid them, especially coming into a valley like that where it came down and ran down the valley. And they caught up with them and just dragged them in. We heard it go up, we went up there, and there was nothing left. Just all the bombs had all gone up.
Did you ever come under fire from the rebels?
Yes, and that's how Wells was shot in the shoulder. He was shot from a mountainside and clean right through his shoulder. Smashed all his shoulder up.
Did you personally come under fire?
Not that I know of. I could have been under fire, but I wouldn't know. You wouldn't hear it because of the noise of the aircraft for start off, and you wouldn't know unless the aircraft was hit itself. And it was found when it went back to the base or back to wherever you were, and you did your normal daily inspection. And if there was any holes in the aircraft, which were all metal then, the Wapiti, and later on the heart I was in India, they were all metal aircraft, you would see a hole through the skin of the aircraft. and you knew then that you'd been fired on, and you got away with it. And they were very, very good marksmen too, with these old blunderbuss type of rifles they had.
What were the problems of air gunning in Iraq? Were there any special problems that you'd have in Iraq that you wouldn't have in England?
Only if we had to go out on operations against any rebels like that. That was the only difference. In England, it was just a matter of practice, practice, practice. There, we were on active service. And we were awarded the Iraq General Service Medal and the King Faisal Medal. I saw it on one of the breasts down there, a white, green, white medal, the last one, King Faisal War Star. I've got that. There weren't too many of those issued. I think there was about less than 100 issued, and I got one of them. And I got it 17 years after I should have done.
I think that you were on an escort to receive King Faisal's body.
Yes, in 70 squadron. When King Faisal died in Switzerland, his body was flown back to Beirut, and we were asked, the Royal Air Force were asked to bring him back from Beirut to Baghdad for burial. And we went over, and I was with Sergeant Sweet and Sergeant Sully, first and second pilots, on a Vickers Victoria, and we picked his body up in the coffin at Beirut and brought him back to Baghdad and sent to the palace. And he was buried in Baghdad, and his son Faisal II took over.
Did you ever travel about Iraq very much whilst you were there?
Yes, I think I just about travelled all over Iraq. There wasn't anything that I didn't see that I wanted to see. I was at Basra for a while. I was attached to 203 Flying Boat Squadron on air gunnery duties there as well, on the flying boats there, the Rangoons. So I saw Basra and that area and the Persian Gulf entrance, and we did all the Persian Gulf patrols with the Navy on 203 Squadron. I saw Dewanir. That's the junction of the Tigris and the Euphrates, where supposedly stands the Tree of Knowledge still. It's rather an old broken-down tree now, but they still say it's the Tree of Knowledge from biblical days. I saw the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the old seven wonders of the world. I went there by car. We used to go. Everyone there had an old Tin Lizzy Ford made up into his own sheath to build it himself. Some were built like sports cars, others were just old drop-down things falling apart, and others were quite good. And we used to drive these old Tin Lizzies all over the place. And I went to Babylon and saw the Hanging Gardens there. I saw the famous Sestouan Arch, the largest unsupported arch in the world, and the home of Nebuchadnezzar when Salome demanded the head of John the Baptist. That was his palace then. Jacob's Ladder, you've got a picture of it there. Erbil, the holy city of Erbil, Mosul, where I, and Kirkuk, the old wells of Kirkuk, where I saw a public hanging there for sheep stealing. There's photographs of it in there. And there was the wild borderland between Iraq and Turkey. But there was a strip there which the Kurds always claimed was Kurdistan. And then you always got this constant bickering between the Kurds and the Iraqis on this strip. And it was all mountain and forestry there. And it was really hard to get at these rebels. They had a real tough time with them, the Iraqi army did, with all their arms and their own aircraft and their own artillery.
When you enter these places like Babylon, were they actual officially organized trips, or...?
No, we just went, and there was always someone there. They're still cleaning things up there and finding little things. And you just go around where the passage... You have arrows and little posters marking, we did then, telling you where you could go, and you must follow the path lines. And there was a little path line strip of tape you followed along, or wherever you want to go.
But did you organise these trips off your own bat, or
yes,
did the RAF organise
them? Yes, we organise ourselves. We just get a car load and off we would go. We weren't allowed to fly within 5 miles of Sestouan Arch because of the vibration of the aircraft. And we weren't allowed to fly within a circle of 5 miles, and if we went over it, not under 10,000 feet because of vibration. case brought it down. It was getting to the state. I've been on the, I climbed up the top of it. You can climb up the side. It comes out the ground like that and goes like that. And you can climb up the sides. And I climbed up there just to say I'd been up there with all the rest. Samara was another holy city I went and saw. That's another place where they train the Ismaili priests.
Can you, you said, mentioned that you were flying in the Wapiti. What did you think of the Wapiti?
Well, compared with the aircraft it took over from, the DH-9A, it was a renovation, really. It came right out of this world. It was the new all-metal aircraft, light bomber. It had a Bristol Pegasus engine in. It was very well built, very substantial, strong. It could do all the jobs that it was required to do. It had a good distance of flying. And there was nothing, I don't think, that I could say against it, personally.
Was it a popular aircraft with the crews?
Yes, it was popular, quite popular with the crews. There was no untold crashes from aircraft failure or engine failure or anything like that that I ever heard of in my time out there, anyway. Except, like, the Russia Bar effort. And there was another one where an Iraqi pilot had one of our gunners in the back. And funny enough, he was at Cranwell when I was there as a cadet. Janabi, Lieutenant Janabi. And he was a lieutenant then when I got back to Iraq, in the Iraqi Air Force. He used to fly with us at times. And he was flying with one of our gunners on New Year's Eve, 1931. And he landed on the airfield after we'd had quite some rain on it. And almost stopped and tipped over on his nose, and his gunner, Chamberlain, had undone his donkey. So we used to have what they call a donkey chain. It was a cable which is attached to your parachute harness here to the floor. It had a quick release, snap release on it. And he'd undone that, thinking, oh, well, we're down now. And the thing tipped over, threw him out. He landed on his head and broke his neck. And he died on New Year's Eve in our hospital there. That's the only two things, and they were both accidents.
What about the planes you were flying with 70 Squadron?
Oh, they would fly forever and ever, the old Vickers Victoria. They were later changed, just as I was leaving, to the Valencia. And all it meant was they took out the Napier Lion engines, which had a very bad fault in the engine itself, in that the big ends of the pistons were white metalled and they overheated, and the white metal ran off the big end bearings and they cracked, and the Conrad went straight down to the sump and knocked the bottom of the engine out, and everything went and you had a dead engine. That was the only fault with an Napier Lion. Well, then they changed them for the Bristol Pegasus engine then, and they altered just the interplane structure to put them in, these new engines, and they were faster, a better engine, and they had a longer distance of flying, too. Quite a bit, I'd say about 100 miles more, to my knowledge, anyway. And they would float in the air just like a bird. You could stop both the engines and you could glide in as easy as that. Didn't need any engines, though. You could glide them in. That was one of the practice for the pilots, to shut off one engine and do a landing on one engine. When he got used to that, shut off both engines and try and land with both engines dead. And if he thought he wasn't going to make it, switch it back on again.
This was with the Victoria?
Yeah.